If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Juan Castillo, and this is the Electric Drum. Now, I have in the studio this morning with me a young man who, you know, I've gotten to know very, very well. His name is Anwar Stokes, and he's into photography, and, you know, he has a great story, one of the unsung heroes here in our community. He owns Stokes Photography in Connecticut. And, you know, he's done some work for WYBC, and he continues to do work for us. And I got him in the studio. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, Juan. Right. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you're from New Haven, but you were raised in Anderson, South Carolina.
Yes, that's correct.
So tell me about South Carolina.
South Carolina is a little different animal. South Carolina itself, growing up there, it's just a small town. Everybody's kind of close-knit. Everybody knows each other. You need a car to get everywhere in Anderson, South Carolina. I like to first off say, too, my high school, Westside High School, one of the great schools there. But it was a great experience. It's a different lifestyle that people have in South Carolina. It's kind of like people kind of stay to themselves. You know, most of the time growing up there, races didn't necessarily intermix in South Carolina. I grew up there with my mom, my stepfather, and my brother in South Carolina. And we, you know, we made things work the best we could.
Now, you grew up in New Haven, so why did your family move to South Carolina?
We moved to South Carolina because my grandmother moved back down to South Carolina. We had always been in between states. My grandmother, Dorothy Agnew, who has since passed, we've always been in between different states. So wherever my grandmother went, my mother made us follow suit. So that's usually how that worked.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. So tell me, you know, in high school, you know, what were some of your hobbies and what did you like to do?
In high school, some of the biggest things I used to do is used to like to party a little bit. You know, we got a little carried away every now and then. Right. We like to party, hang out. Usually go over to my friend's house. We were still playing Sega Genesis. Nintendo had faded off. We go by his house. My boy Jason in South Carolina. We go by his house and we go, you know, hang out, cook on the grill. A lot of times we were, I was the comedian of the group, you know, so it was like, okay. That was kind of like my claim to fame. I wasn't good at sports or anything like that. So
y'all was playing the dozens.
Yeah. So we always played the dozens. So I was that guy people would look to for laughter, and laughter kept me getting, kept me in trouble and kept me from getting beat up too. So,
well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, growing up, you know, like, you know, I used to stand on the corner in Brooklyn and everybody used to play the dozens. And there was this one guy, right, Arnold, that, you know, you could throw a little something at him, but you knew better than to stay away from him, because if he came back at you, you had to go home after he hit you off. Were you one of them guys? Were you Arnold?
Yeah, I was. I was one of the guys who kind of led the charge. We used to at Westside High School. We would there would be a group of guys, and we would stand on both sides of the hallway. And as people would walk by, we would play the dozens. So you would be victim, prey, or perpetrator. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
well, it's in our culture, man. You know, Donald Trump right now is trying to play the dozens.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he is.
That is true. Yeah, that is really true. Yeah, he's something else. He is something else.
You know, but in any case, man. Okay, so besides having a good time partying and playing the dozens, you know, I mean, were you a good student? You know, I mean,
absolutely. Okay. I think that's where I shine too, as well. I enjoyed attending school. I think one of my highlights was actually the book work. I wasn't on the dean's list all the time, but I made it a few times. But I think one of the greatest achievements that I had was teachers respected me, and I was a respectful student. I was one of the students who would stay and help others and, you know, kind of help people get through their day with laughter. I think a lot of times I excelled in computer literacy. That was one of the areas I excelled in. I still love computers to this day. It's just something I kind of gravitated towards. In terms of using the keyboard and understanding different programs and things of that nature. So school, I enjoy school. I enjoy learning.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, like I've had a lot of people on the show And, you know, we talk about obstacles in their lives. And, you know, we all have obstacles. Some are much different than others. Some are more pronounced than others. You know, but it's interesting. I mean, you know, growing up a black man in America, you know, you growing up in South Carolina, you know, a segregated pretty much, you know, town. There were a lot of obstacles you had to get over, man. And I guess laughter was part of trying to get around that, right?
Absolutely.
You know, but on the most part, you know, you were able to overcome that. What motivated you to do that, man? I mean, you know, because I mean, it's also the stories of people like us, you know, who who end up selling drugs and doing other things, mm-hmm. right? You know, so what motivated you to kind of stay on the right path?
I had a great support group from my mother Rosemary to my aunt Desi, to my aunt Jeannie, who's since passed on. I mean, I had a great support group. My grandmother, it was a network of love, and a network of love, even with my brother involved, Bryant. It was a support system that was just there. It was intact. It was church first, family second, and everything else kind of fell into place after that. Mm. That was the great thing. Grandmother always taught me to keep God first, and that's just been the leader in my life. So that's been a great opportunity for me. And we were just grounded. We had to go to church every Sunday. If you didn't feel like getting up, the belt helped you get up out of bed. That was motivation to overcome barriers.
Yes.
The other piece about it was, is that, you know, we always kind of, the South maintained us with the yes, ma'am, the no, sir. It was a line of respect that we didn't cross. It wasn't any gray areas in terms of your ability to kind of deviate from the norm in the South. The South had very strict rules. When I was growing up, they were still paddling kids in school. So it would be nothing for a principal to call up a student. He paddle you, call your parents up, and they send you back to the classroom. Mom come up or dad come up there in agreement with it, and you went about your day.
Juan Castillo, I'm speaking with Anwar Stokes. You know, he's a photographer here in the city. He's the owner of Stokes Photography, CT. And, you know, he grew up in South Carolina, you know, was born here in New Haven, Connecticut. And we're talking about his life in high school, you know, in South Carolina, you know, and at Westside High School, as a matter of fact. And we're talking about, you know, right now we're talking about, you know, some paddling, right? You know, you know, of course, you know, that's a difficult thing to do today, you know, because, you know, you're going to go to jail.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely. The laws have changed for sure.
Absolutely. You know, and I mean, just to a large degree, you know, within reason, you know, because I think that, you know, some people were being abused, you know, sometimes that doesn't work, for you it worked.
Yeah, it was one of those things that where, you know, we grew up in a different time. So at that point in time, there hadn't been a lot of rules established around abuse and neglect. I think it was more or less like, you know, it was those good old days where tree branches were still being used. Not that I agree with that all the time, but it was something. And I think what also kind of helped me a lot of times, too, was just I respected my mother. I respected my mother and my aunts and family. It's just I had such a love for them and still do that kind of carried me further than any type of physical discipline. It was just something ingrained in me from growing up as a little boy that, you know, we just had to have that respect and love. And my family shows that like unconditionally. So it's a great feeling to be a part of my family.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned about the yes, ma'am, yes, sir. You know, growing up in Brooklyn myself, you know, and then, you know, there wasn't no yes, ma'am, and yes, sir growing up in Brooklyn. I mean, there was other ways to show respect, of course. You know, but by the same token, you know, when I came to Connecticut and, you know, there's a lot of Southern influence here in this town, you know,
sure.
And I heard that. I heard that all the time, you know, and then I noticed that when young people, as well as, you know, mature individuals are referred to someone that they respected and they use the word yes, ma'am, or yes, sir, that there was a certain amount of not only respect, but is a way that folks looked at you when you said that word, that even in the middle of like, you know, in my situation, you know, people are coming and asking me a lot of things, you know,
absolutely.
You know, the radio station, you know, is here and, you know, we're here to help the community. So people are always asking and it happens a lot. Pray for me, family, you know, and sometimes I got to say no. Right.
Sure.
You know, but I think that, but one of the things I notice is that, you know, if I'm respectful while I'm doing that people accept that a whole lot better. If I just say, no, it can't be done. You know, thank you so much for calling, you know,
absolutely.
And that goes a long way, you know, and you know, you also a juvenile parole officer.
Correct.
And we're going to talk about how that, you know, is important in your work and evaluating your clients and trying to help them. But that's a story that we're going to go on a little later. So you're in high school and it's time for graduation. So absolutely. So what happens?
So after graduating from Westside High, there was a conversation that was had with my stepfather. I don't know if it was a conversation or more or less. He walked into the room and laid down a couple options. he said, either you're going to go to college, you're going to work full time, or you're going to join the military. So with those three options on the table, you know, after talking to some of my friends and seeing some of the directions they were going, friends are going off to college, some were joining the military, and I had to really, you know, I had to get it together. I was 18, so I had to really figure it out. So I wind up, I did investigate, I'll say inquire about the military, but it wasn't a good fit for me.
Right.
You know, a little too rigid, and I'm a little too lackadaisical, like to laugh a little too much. So
yeah. No dozens in the Army.
No dozens in the Army, that's for sure. So Mom was gracious enough to intervene throughout that opportunity I was about to embark on. So I didn't wind up doing that. After high school, I started working at UPS in Anderson, South Carolina, and I worked there for some time. And while I was there, I learned a lot of great things. How to work under pressure was one of them. But I had an opportunity to work at UPS for probably about 7 or 8 months. And I had another great influence in my life as well, which we'll discuss, I know, at some point. But
yes.
My friend Jason, his father, Keith McDuffie, amazing person. Great influence. He was the one who actually brought me out of that UPS funk, I call it, because I was so happy with the idea of making $9.75 an hour. You couldn't tell me nothing. With $9.75 an hour, I was on top of the world, 18 years old, no kids. I didn't have a car. But at $9.75 in Anderson, South Carolina, I felt like a millionaire.
Right.
So with that said, you know, I had a couple conversations and I realized that job wasn't going anywhere and I wasn't the best at that job. And that took some, I think, tough realization, too, to realize, you know, I wasn't the best truck loader. I forgot the exact title, but I wasn't the best at that job. So through conversations with my friend's father, Keith McDuffie, he led me in another direction towards college.
Mm.
After about seven months or so working at UPS, I stopped by his house one day and Keith was very... Keith didn't pull any punches. We'll say that. He pulled no punches. So when you talk to Keith, he was very forthright, very straightforward with you, and just kind of let you know, hey, brother, look, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? You're 18 years old. You can't work at UPS for the rest of your life. He's like, you need to go to college. And I was like worried about money. Where's that money going to come from? Keith said, man, don't worry about the money. He said, the money's going to come. He said, I have Jason, who's in college, his son, which was in college at the time. He says, I'm going to drop off a care package to him. He says, you're going to get in the truck with me, and we're going to ride to St. Augustine's College.
Mm.
And I said, so I went home, had the conversation with my mom. My mom was supportive. She was like, yes, son, I think it's a great plan for you. So we took that trip.
Right.
Off to St. Augustine we went for the first visit, and I saw some of the women running around campus. That was very enticing.
Motivation.
Yeah, so that was a little bit of motivation for me. So after I saw them and, you know, and saw some of the other activities I could be involved in that would help me become more successful, it was a no-brainer. I look back at UPS and I was thankful for that opportunity, but I look forward towards college and it was just an amazing opportunity and I would do college over again.
Wow.
I would.
That's awesome. Tell me about some of the experiences at St. Augustine. Historical Black College.
Yes, sir.
You know, and CIAA.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell me about that.
So St. Augustine's College. Oh, man, I love my alma mater. St. Augustine was an amazing experience. Met a lot of great people at St. Augustine. One of the things I think St. Augustine taught me was perseverance. Mm-hmm. Perseverance, sticking through the tough times. Because for those who went to HBCUs know that when it was time to get registered or validated, as they called it, the process wasn't easy by any means.
Yes.
There were times, I won't say opportunities, but there were times where we would be in line literally from 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning until maybe 4 in the afternoon. The financial aid office would go to lunch at around about 12 or 1. The line would break up. You would have to jump back in line after lunch and pray you got to be seen by them.
Mm.
Then when you got seen by financial aid, maybe there was a piece of paper missing here, a piece of paper missing there. You would have to call mom. I'd be like, I call my mother. I say, hey, mom. I said, they're telling me my financial aid isn't in order. And she's like, just hold on. Mommy's going to take care of it. My mom would sign whatever she needed to sign. We got the ball rolling. My amazing dean that I had there, Dean Knowles, just awesome guy. Just like... another father figure in your life. You know how people intercede and interject into your life. He was just a great guy, a great mentor, a great counselor. Learned a lot. We did our share again of partying. I majored in criminal justice while at St. Augustine College, which I'm very proud of. One of my other professors, Professor Jarrett, amazing guy. I think one of the best things I can say about HBCU is to see successful black people moving and shaking. The entire campus was filled with successful black folks, and it was it's something that I think you don't realize until you're actually in that environment and have an opportunity to experience it, that you are just it's positively overwhelming to see folks that are so successful and giving knowledge back to younger folks to help them be successful, because a lot of time the institutions that we attend, you know, don't necessarily reflect who we are as a race or where we're from necessarily, but we have had African-American folks and people from different countries of African ethnicities that were giving back to some extent. Despite it being their jobs, they had they brought forth a level of knowledge and power that is you can only get from an HBCU.
Right, right. That's great, man. So 2003, you graduate with a criminal justice degree.
Yes, sir.
Any opportunities out there when you got out?
So, when I got out of college, I did my little time there. And, I wouldn't say little time. I stayed a little longer than I should have, but I graduated in 2003. After I left college, my Aunt Desi was living in Raleigh, North Carolina. I didn't have a lot of job opportunities. I did an internship with the Raleigh PD with the hopes of getting on to the police department. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. But I had a place to lay my head. So my aunt allowed me to stay there for some time to gather myself and my thoughts to see if, you know, what did I want to do? Did I want to come back here to Connecticut and be with my mother, or did I want to stay in North Carolina? I stayed there for some time. I just didn't see a lot of opportunities that came up for me. I had made some community connections while I was there, but it just didn't pan out. And I love the city of Raleigh. If you ever have an opportunity to go to Raleigh, it's a beautiful place. Beautiful place, beautiful folks. Just high enough above the Mason-Dixon line for me,
right,
to where you know you feel okay. We'll say that,
right.
So, so I just it didn't really pan out after college. So I still have my connections there and friends that I made. So I wind up coming back to Connecticut after graduation.
So you eventually become a juvenile parole officer.
Yes, sir.
Right. Tell me about that work.
So that path eventually led. I originally started at the Department of Children and Families in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. That time escapes me right now. I believe since 2008. And I started off as a social worker in the treatment department, working with some families here in the New Haven area. A great opportunity that these families provide you with the educational experience. First off, I'd like to thank the families, too, for allowing me into their homes, because I know it's a difficult experience working with a stranger, trying to get an understanding of your lifestyle and what you've been through within a six-month or one-year period. And I'm grateful for so many opportunities that these families provided me with their insight. So I started off in a treatment unit, essentially working with families to address issues of abuse and neglect, lack of financial resources, trying to help families identify resources in their community that would be beneficial to them, reviewing treatment plans that will help families hopefully get to that next level, or at least give them some type of almost a roadmap. The goal of working with families is to give them some type of roadmap to help them be self-sufficient.
How did you get around? Because, look, it's a stigma associated with DCF, right?
Sure.
You know, and a lot of times, you know, families are very tough to deal with and to try to help because of the stigma that they feel, right? Talk about that.
That's important that you bring that up. I think what's been beneficial to me helping some of the families that I have helped, I think, is just really just treating people as they are, treating people as people and seeing them for who they are and not seeing them for their problems that they have, because we all have issues. I think a lot of times when I go into the houses and I deal with families, I talk to them as if they're my family member, because I know they're loved by someone. And I come in and I use a real easygoing approach. I'm not there to tell you what to do. I'm not there to tell you how to change your life. I'm giving you options and opportunities to make different choices in life. A lot of times people just respect that. I come in, I'm respectful. I still ask people to have a seat on their couch. Just because I know this is, you know, it's a huge change. It's a huge shakeup when you have a stranger knock at your door. And the first thing people think of is a removal. And that's not always necessarily the case. So it's just, I think the key to working with people in certain circumstances, in all circumstances, is respect. We talked about that before and how that can cross any bridge, that can build bridges, is that level of respect that you have for the family that you're working with.
Right. That's great. So, how did you get into, you know, parole?
So I recently transitioned or had the opportunity to join this great team here in New Haven. Shout out to my supervisor, Mike Caffey, awesome team that I'm working with. I recently transitioned to them about 2 years ago. It was from a pool of candidates. A lot of folks had applied for it, and I was so grateful and thankful that they wind up choosing me for this opportunity. I have a degree in criminal justice, previously employed at Lake Grove at Durham, and in Durham, Connecticut here, which was the largest residential facility here in the state at one point in time. So with that experience, my criminal justice background, I believe, and, you know, me being a stellar person that I am, gave me the opportunity to work with this group. And I work with a great group of people over there. And I love actually what I do, because now I have an opportunity to still to blend my criminal justice degree with the opportunity to helping families and helping adjudicated youth. Most of my caseload consists of working with adolescent males. So I have an opportunity to kind of I don't want to use the big brother phrase, but I use I'll say guidance counselor. Mm-hmm. I think that's the easiest part to put it, because I never want to try and supersede in these young folks' life that I'm a father figure or anything like that. But I have a great opportunity to work with them when they're at their lowest point. Most often than not, these young folks have been adjudicated for serious crimes. They come into our juvenile justice system, and we're able to work with them and provide them with services that can kind of help uplift them and have them thinking another way. There's another way. And it's great to see change. That's what I love about life, to be able to see change and growth. It's just so amazing to see some young folks who change. And unfortunately, there's a population that still that won't change. And that's a real reality I think we have to deal with, is that there is a population of folks that who are just unwilling to or don't have the necessarily tools with inside themselves to change. So juvenile parole is great. Throughout the entire state of Connecticut, in terms of my work, I work with a lot of great providers here throughout the state of Connecticut to help get these young folks back on track.
Cool. Juan Castillo with you. I'm speaking with Anwar Stokes. He's a juvenile parole officer here in Connecticut, and you know, also owns Stokes Photography CT. We're going to talk about that in a little while. You know, and we've been talking about his life. So question. I mean. You know, so much of the so-called crime, you know, in our cities and in the country attributed to young people, right? You know, that somehow they're the ones that are, you know, committing all the crimes, and, you know, we got a problem, right? You know, and unfairly, you know, they focus on African-American youth, right?
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of statistics that talk about all the high unemployment for our youth in the country, and lack of opportunities. And you're dealing with some of those folks, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and I just want to ask you, you know, what are the factors that you think are causing, you know, such a high rate of issues with our youth?
That's an excellent question, Juan. Really excellent question. One of the things I think myself and a lot of coworkers that we talk about are the systemic issues that continue to plague impoverished neighborhoods, which are predominantly filled with, in the city of New Haven, I'll say African-American, Hispanic families, minorities. A lot of times these are systemic issues of multi-generational welfare,
mm-hmm.
Lack of great education, under-education, lack of job opportunities. We all know that how difficult it is here in the United States to redeem yourself after you've committed a crime and you received a felony on your record. I think what the department has done, the department has begun to look at it from a different lens, and they have changed their way of thinking in terms of incarceration for African-American males who predominantly make up most of the juvenile justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And what that has done is, I think it has it's done two things. It has it has, from the top down, it has created a new awakening that people do realize that African-American males are predominantly the ones being incarcerated in juvenile facilities and adult facilities. But on the other hand, it has opened up a door of unaccountability now, because it seems to be it's too lackadaisical or too loose to some extent with the laws in terms of holding people accountable. I'm a firm believer that if you break the law, obviously you should be held accountable for that crime. But I think it has, the pendulum has swung so far to the left as to where there isn't any accountability to some extent.
Mm.
So I think we do a disservice there as well to our youth. A lot of times I think society as a whole, we have to address these issues of multi-generational welfare and really dig deep and figure out why is it that our grandparents are on welfare, then the daughters are on, then the daughter's children are on. Why is it that I've seen in juvenile court that I've seen multiple generations of families having CPS issues? Why haven't these issues been resolved at some point? We got to really dig deep in that, and that takes time, it takes money, it takes resources. But I think until we get to that point, we're never going to see any changes. You're going to constantly have young men who are committing these crimes. One thing I will say, and this is just touched my mind right now, as I look back to the Hillary Clinton administration. I don't want to make this political, but they developed those under Bill Clinton. They developed the Three Strikes You're Out law, mm-hmm. which predominantly affected African American and minority communities, which removed fathers out of the home for some trivial and some very serious crimes. And that impact is still being felt now, because we know once you break up a family unit can be invaded, and mm-hmm. it can be invaded from all aspects, whether that be drug, poverty, crime, child, sex trade, prostitution. There are so many different avenues that can affect this family now, because the family unit is now broken. You have a lot of single mothers doing the best they can, trying to raise these young people, trying to raise young men to be young men, which I think is a very difficult task when there's no male figures in the community, because they've all been removed due to past legislation, past poor decision making. So there are a lot of things that are plaguing. I think one piece, and I'll leave you with this, is we can't continue to just keep throwing money at it and hoping that the situation will get better.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you know, my perspective is that somehow I think we're all looking for a hand up. We're not looking for a handout. Right.
Sure.
And, you know, a hand up is really all about like, OK, you know, you need some help right now because, you know, things are very extremely difficult for you. But here's a plan for you to, you know, come out of this. And at the same time, you know, here's a job that is not just a job that's going to keep you in poverty, mm-hmm. but, you know, here's a job that's going to allow you at some point through growth to be able to send your kids to college.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, the poverty rate in the United States is $12,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, you know, so if I'm making $20,000 a year, I'm not poor. I'm very, very poor at $20,000 a year.
Very much so.
Right? You know, and so just having some realistic kinds of, you know, data that we can draw from to help folks. But even most important than that, I mean, I think that, you know, it's probably time for us to start looking at developing jobs and not waiting for the private sector to basically, you know, give us jobs.
Absolutely.
You know, the private sector has been routinely making billions of dollars and not growing their business by providing more jobs, because they claim that business is not good. Well, if you're walking away with $15 billion, business mm-hmm. is pretty good.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, very much so.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree, but like if you open up another factory and you hire more workers, and that factory is making widgets, and now those same workers are now getting a living wage to be able to buy more widgets, shouldn't you be able to make more money and grow the economy? You see what I'm saying?
No, I see what you're saying.
And so I talk to, my whole thing is that, you know, I want businesses to hear what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
All right, because, you know, That's how we're going to change this, man. By the end of the day, that's how we're going to change this. Well, okay, so tell me about some of your success stories, in working with parole.
Sure, sure. One of my success stories I'll share is a young man who was Young man who lives here in New Haven. He had a very troubled past. He was, to be honest, he's one of my stick-up kids. Mm-hmm. He's one of the kids who used to run around putting a gun in people's face and taking property from them. You know, he was placed at the training school, did some rehabilitative therapy, kind of saw the error of his ways, had a great family, still has a great family, which I think is key to any young person's success. Mm-hmm. Having positive role models, other people in your family being successful, I think that's very integral in helping these young folks get out of that. So a great support group is something that he had. So after he left the training school, you know, he reintegrated back into New Haven, wind up signing up for college here at Gateway. We closed out his case early. He's just, it's just one of those stories that you hear about and it happens. Because we hear so much of the negative, but to see a young man who was down in the depths with an opportunity to continue that negative lifestyle, but he chose a different way.
Right.
Very intellectual, very smart, very book savvy. But to register for Gateway, 3.4 or so GPA he had prior to us closing his case, that's amazing. It's just amazing. Other cases I've been involved in, there have been cases where young people have come back to the house. They begin working with some of the providers that we have for them in the community, and giving a portion of their money that they earn back to their mom or whomever they're living with, reintegrating back into the family, and to see that they have those capabilities and the family is welcoming them back into the home. I mean, that's huge. It's huge to go back in and hear mothers and I want my son to be home with me. I'm so thankful for what you guys have done. You know, that's something that you can't really quantify that. You can't really put that anywhere.
It's great.
It's a great feeling.
That's awesome. And, you know, I did a show on restorative justice, a couple of months ago.
Okay.
And, one of the issues that is really that the community needs to understand is that, you know, if you go to jail and while you're in jail, you're paying your dues. Mm-hmm. And when you come home, your dues are paid.
Correct.
And too often, you know, people are still asking you to pay more dues while you're in the street.
Absolutely.
I already paid my dues.
Absolutely.
And I think that holds people back because it's like, okay, you know, you haven't been out here long enough for me to give you a chance. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? Why? You know, it's like, you know, why do I got to wait a couple of more years because you think I need to still do more time on the street now?
No, absolutely.
You know, and I think that's important. Okay, so we're going to switch gears here. Speaking with Anwar Stokes, a New Haven resident who was born here, raised in South Carolina, went to, St. Augustine, University College, actually, Historical Black College in Raleigh, worked with DCF, is now, a juvenile parole officer, been talking about his life. I know you've been inspired. I know I have. One of the unsung heroes here in our community, man, you know. So photography, right?
Yes,
you know,
sir.
You own Stokes Photography, CT?
Correct.
I got to tell you a story before you get into this.
Absolutely.
It's interesting because, growing up in New York, back in the day, right? The only people that ran around with cameras and taking pictures were the Japanese. They would come to New York City and they would be taking pictures and pictures and pictures. And we used to wonder, man, why are they taking all these pictures? And
sure.
What's the deal? We didn't have camera phones. Mm-hmm. Most people that were taking pictures in America were professional photographers, pretty much.
Absolutely.
You know, you had some people that was their hobby, but you didn't see that many cameras running around.
This is true.
The cameras on our phones.
Yeah.
And everybody's taking pictures, selfies, this, that,
oh,
the other.
Yes. Oh,
it's amazing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but tell me about your experience with photography, and when was that day that it clicked for you?
Well, I'll take you back. I got to walk you back a little bit.
Yes.
My father, who's in West Haven, Mr. Lofton, who's in West Haven, was a photographer. And while we were living with him, it was me, my mother, and my brother there. We lived with him there. And I remember as a little kid, I remember going into his dark room. He had a dark room set up in the laundry room of the apartment. And I remember that room being red. I remember there being like these bins filled with some kind of liquid. And I could never tell you what that liquid was, but I remember seeing there were pictures inside this liquid. And I remember there being a string hanging over those pictures in those bins with photographs being clipped to them. And I presume from this day, I never really got deep with it, but I presume they were drying. I presume he was developing photographs. And over time, as I've talked to him, that's what it was. He had his own dark room that he created. My mother still has pictures of us when we were little, when he would take photographs of me when we were at a horse farm. Black and white photos. I believe he's using a 35 millimeter camera. So this photography piece may be in my blood and I don't know it.
Right, may be in
my blood. So a few years ago, I say probably approximately about 4 years ago, I wind up really picking up a new camera, picked up a DSLR camera and started just snapping pictures. You look at a camera now, it's so complicated, all these buttons and knobs and nodules and apertures and things like that. So started shooting photographs periodically. I put it down, got frustrated with it. I didn't get the results I wanted. Pick it back up, put it on automatic. I get the shots I wanted, but I felt like I was cheating because it was on automatic. Right. And I wanted to be the guy who could say, hey, I know how to take it in shutter priority, or I know how to take the photograph in aperture priority. So I once again put it down. Then as time went on, my daughter was born, and then I began taking more photographs periodically. We would go on family vacations. I would snap a couple photos, and you know, periodically you get people to look at a photo, be like, "Oh man, that's a nice photo,"
right?
And you'd be like, "Yeah, okay, I appreciate it." And then I go on the internet and look at some of the photos. I'd be like, "Man, I can't show nobody this photo." You know what I mean? So, so over time, as I progressed and I continue to just do more reading and watching more videos and hanging around people who are lovers of photography, lovers of light, as we call them, as well. Just ingratiating myself with those folks, it just became more and more for me. And just thinking out loud. And I as time went on, we went on a family vacation to Bermuda, and I was snapping some photos there. The anticipation of getting them back, I was so excited to get the photographs back. Some were great, some were not, but I felt like there was something there. There's something in my heart that told me, like, you know, there could be something here. Some time went along and I took some more photographs, and then that one person, and I can't remember who it was, and forgive me if I don't remember your name, but one person says to me, you know what, you should get paid for this because these are some really good photos. And this is, we're talking maybe this is about maybe 2.5, maybe 3 years ago. And, you know, you never really give it any thought. I don't have a lot of capital to get started. I need all this equipment. So I had an opportunity to save up a little bit of money, buy some of the equipment that I needed. And I actually went out on a limb. I followed my heart, and I went out on a limb, and I started taking photographs. I had the support of Elizabeth, my daughter's mother. Mm-hmm. I had the support of her as well, which she's great. With her support, and you know, just talking to different family members, they were, you know, a lot of positive people told me, like, you know, you might have something here. You might have something here. So I would say earlier this year, in April 11th of this year, I really went to an undertaking. I really went deep. And started thinking, like, you know what, either it's now or never, because I felt like I blew my 20 years, my 20 year old years. I felt like I just threw those away. So I
well, it's not athletics now.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So, no, that is true. So. No, that is true. But I felt like I had an opportunity where I could be doing something a lot sooner. But
yes,
you know, but God is amazing. So I have the opportunity now, and I started up the business, and I've had a lot of great customers who've come to me, and you know, and trust me, because the thing about photography, I think people have to understand is we have the camera phones, and those are great, and they work amazing. But I think people have to get back in the idea of having tangible photographs. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like holding a photograph in your hand. A photograph takes you back to a place to where you can remember. You and I can look at the same photograph, Juan, and you think of one memory and I think of another memory.
Right.
So photographs are amazing. It's just
worth 1,000 words. Right?
Oh, absolutely. I love it. It's a passion of mine, and I got such a great support around me regarding this work. I'm just excited. I'm excited, and I'm so thankful for the opportunity of being here.
And I just want to let you folks know that, Anwar Stokes is you know, is the man behind all the photos that you see on Facebook that I put up. As well as I got other photographers that also allow me to use, you know, some of the photos that they use. But that the Good Morning New Haven photos of all the photos across the city that I put up, they're his work, you know. And YBC, we thank you, man. You know,
oh, thank you. We thank you very much.
I mean, you
I'm
know,
very grateful.
We love New Haven, and as you see, you know, by my Facebook, you know, posts, you know, and our photos, you know. We love New Haven. And and so that's really what it's all about. Now, you know, in the spring, we're going to be having an exhibition here at the radio station of Mr. Stokes' photographs of the city and other photos that he's taken. We're going to have a reception here for him, and we're going to have, some refreshments, and, you know, we're going to have the community come in, you know, and meet Mr. Stokes and enjoy these photos, you know, as we partake, you know, with a little, you know, light fare, you know, real classy, you know what I mean? You know, so make sure that you're listening for that. You know, you're going to have to win to get in too, right? You know, on YBC, you got to win, man. Listen, brother, I want to thank you for coming, man. You know, your story is one of, you know, commitment to your family, you know, to education, to the community, you know, and to art. You know, without art, you know, there is no life, I believe.
Right. True. You know? So true.
So what's the best advice you ever got, and from who?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a really good question. I'm going to have to take it over to my man, Eric Clemens, over at Concat, who's the CEO and president of Concat. I think one of the best advice, and this is just one of many, but this is so tough, but this always sticks out in my head.
Yes.
Is that a lot of times, Eric and I worked together some time ago at Job Corps, and one of the things he told me that always sticks out in my head is he says a lot of times when you go into meetings, and I'm starting to become more business oriented, obviously. He said a lot of times when you go into meetings, he says, the meeting has already happened before you got there. He said, the meeting's already taken place.
Mm.
So with that said, and it was so impactful to me, because a lot of times as a new person, a young person coming into the business world, a lot of times we have plans and we go into these meetings thinking we know. And a lot of times the decision's already been made before you've even arrived at the meeting.
Right.
So it was just a profound statement that he made to me. And it's always stuck with me. And it still sticks with me to this day, that when you think about it, when you're preparing for something and you're going into it, the decision's already been made. And you can look at that from a spiritual side. You can look at that from a business side.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
that means that you got to be in the meeting before the meeting.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. You do. So
that's great.
So that would be one of the most best things that stands out to me.
You got a daughter. So I know you got to shout out.
Yes,
your daughter.
My daughter Nia Stokes. I love her so much.
And her mom.
I share her with Elizabeth Stokes, who is one of the best co-parents I could ever ask for. She's just amazing, so supportive to me and my daughter. And Nia is, if you see her from time to time on Instagram, she's my part-time model. When I can bribe her, she's a model for me. But other than that, there are days and she doesn't want to work. I know the child labor laws, but I think she's beautiful. So I may be. I get a little over zealous sometimes putting up photos of her, but that's my girl. I love her so much.
Wonderful, man. Well, thank you for coming, brother.
No, thank you for having me, Juan. Thank you very much.
We appreciate you, brother.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you to YBC and the family here.
Absolutely. Juan Castillo with you. I know you've been inspired. I know I have. This is Juan Castillo. This is the Electric Drum. We will see you next week.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.